Hello everybody, James here, and it's Ask Dutch Anything. As I'm sure you well know, we are going to be very quickly running through the plugs, and right there is a University of Dutch hat held by the Dutchman himself, Dirty Dutch Mantel. He has two books over his shoulder, The World According to Dutch and Tales from a Dirt Road. If you want them unsigned, you go to Amazon. If you want them signed, you make your request at dirtydutchmantel@gmail.com. Dutch also has certificates from the University of Dutch that he signs himself with your name on it. Very classy looking things. Get them now for Christmas. There's an example of one with my name on it, in fact. I have the ring light's blurring it out now. Anyway, I have two books as well, Owen Hart and The Rock. Fine books on both gentlemen, the best books ever written on both of them, and you can get those from Amazon. The links are in the description. Excuse me, saliva's filling my mouth. I have a podcast with Shane Douglas, Franchise University with Shane Douglas. You can find that on all podcast platforms every Tuesday, and you can find the full episodes and clips on Shane Douglas' official YouTube channel. Links are in the description as always. And most important, the most salient point, I know you like that word, Dutch, questions.
Salient. What does that mean?
Gold. Most relevant, I suspect, something like that. questions for dutch@gmail.com is how you write in to submit your question for the crafty veteran, the Dirty Dutchman himself, Dutch Mantel. And so many of you, goodness me, so many of you do. We try our best to get
We announced our 101,000 subscribers?
We did that on the previous show, yes. We sort of overshot our target almost on that.
Yeah, 101,000. I'm so proud of that.
Yeah, we got 2,000 subscribers in a week.
How many people out there can say, hey, I do a podcast and I got 101,000 subscribers?
Not many.
Not very many.
Not many.
Not many in a world of 8 billion people.
Mm, not many.
So wait a minute. With 8 billion people, we only have 100,000 subscribers?
No, you're looking at the negative there. That's the most glass half empty. Now,
I went right to the negative already. Yeah, we should have like a million. No, but we're working on 125,000 right now.
Okay, 125,000. So keep on subscribing, everybody.
That's our goal. Keep on subscribing.
Yep. Questions for Dutch at gmail.com, as I say, and so many of you have. And the first question we have for, and I keep meaning to ask this, guys, but it was always at the end and I never got around to it. But John in Yorkshire says, good morning, afternoon, evening, James and Dutch. I have only recently found the show a pleasing diversion from the dirge of mediocrity in the wrestling podcast space these days. Well, you should have subscribed. Hopefully you have. Dutch,
yes.
Which referees did you particularly enjoy or not working with? In the modern era, with the referee's role seemingly much diminished, what makes a good referee? Many thanks for your time.
Oh, a referee. I used to work so much with these referees. I'd work an angle with the referees almost not every match, but I'm going to go back years and years ago, and people in Georgia will remember Charlie Smith. Oh, what an active referee he was. And he was entertaining in the dressing room. So when you got him in the ring, he was very good. Ronnie West, he was another one that was great. One of the, who are the two twins?
The Hebners.
The Hebners, they were great. And Jerry Calhoun in Memphis, he was very, very good. And those were the best referees I worked with. I worked with one referee one time that was in Florida, and he was an amateur wrestler. And I was trying to get heat. But this is what I've dealt with. And every time I was trying to get heat that the referee wasn't supposed to see, he would catch it. And I couldn't get heat. And finally I got in the dressing room. I said, brother, I'm trying to get heat out there, but you're catching everything I'm doing. And he says, well, I know that you're doing it. I went, get the hell away from me. And I can't remember his name now. He wasn't a referee long, thank God. But these referees were great. I used to do finishes with the referees where I'd hook the top rope and, you know, over a sunset flip, and a referee would break, and then kick the hands, and I'd go back 1, 2, 3. Oh, people would come up. Then I'd get after the referee and like, I'm going to get you. And Sometimes I caught him, sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I caught him, got him down, and the babyface would make the save. But, I mean, that makes a part of the match that's different. And you could take that at any time and turn it into an angle. And actually, we did turn it into an angle one time where I challenged the referee. And I said I could whip his ass blindfolded. And what happened? He got in the ring, and I said, I am going to kill you. And the little referee's over there, and he had like a T-shirt on and some shorts. He looked like hell. He looked like a skinny guy next door. And I put the blindfold on, but then all of a sudden, a baby face slid in and told the referee to get out of the way. And finally, then he went to lay down. We locked up, and I hit him, and he fell down, right? Mm-hmm. Or I hit him on the back or something, and the baby face fell down like the referee, and I was trying to feel around, and all of a sudden, my foot hit him. Oh, I got you now, you SOB. And I pulled him up, and I tried to hit him. He blocked it. Then he hit me 1, 2, 3, a big slam, a drop kick, another slam, and pinned me 1, 2, 3, and the babyface slid out, and the referee took the blindfold off. And all I saw when I got up was a referee standing over there like this. And I said, and then I went after him and he took off. But the people loved that because it told a story. He outsmarted me, and that's how easy it was to turn it into an angle. But those were I think I did that with Ronnie West. That was good. It was in Continental.
As you bring your microphone closer to you, I will ask you this question. The fellow here, yes. John, says, modern referees' role seemingly much diminished. In a sense, maybe true. In a sense, not. In the sense that you've got an earpiece now and they're constantly listening to directions and giving directives to the wrestlers, you know, speed up, slow down, that kind of thing. Yep. So a referee's job is entirely different almost these days.
Yeah, well, the referee always gave you cues anyway. When to go, when you go on, stretch it out or whatever. But now they're just not a part of the match. I think that's what he's talking about. It's not diminished. It's actually increased. You just don't see it. So the referee is giving cues from the back now. And I don't know what that referee is hearing. I think he's just hearing from the desk, from the table, from the go position. But if he's got a part in there, you know, he's still going to do it. But I don't think it's decreased. I think it's kind of increased, except you just don't see it.
Freddie, do you remember being present for the official debut of the Mankind character? The match was Undertaker versus Justin Hawk Bradshaw when Mankind made his debut proper after weeks of vignettes.
I don't remember that. I don't think. I think I was already gone by then.
You were at ringside. Why don't we have a look?
I was?
Oh, you're at ringside for it. Yeah, 1 minute. Let's find it. Right, so here we go. There you are, right there.
I thought you said Mankind.
Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute. Oh. Well, they needed to run that back. He only missed that by a foot. Oh, son of a... Where'd that son of a bitch come from? I had nothing to do with this, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, there you go. You're scooping Bradshaw out there.
Oh, yeah. That Mankind was crazy. See, they told a great story with him. And they told a story that he kind of... They didn't tell a story that you couldn't believe. You could actually kind of get into that, the Mankind story.
This is the famous shot of it, and then I'll pause and we'll talk about Mick Foley in a minute. With the big elbow.
There it is. Yep, boom.
There we go.
That kind of backed it up. That kind of hurt a little bit. Can you back it up just a second?
Oh, yeah.
See how he landed?
Hang on one sec. I'll share again. Oh, I've lost it now. There you are.
And watch this. Watch him. He hits high up too. Watch. See, he landed on him. And that kind of, oh yeah. That's like 240, 60 pounds landing on you to the side, granted. But Undertaker felt that. Didn't hurt him, but he felt it. And a lot of times, that's what Abdullah, when he would drop the elbow,
oh, yeah.
He dropped the body. Stan Hansen really dropped the body. They would land to the side, but you damn sure knew that they had dropped something on you because you could feel it. Not enough to hurt you, but enough to know that if they wanted to really land on you, they could hurt you.
So there you go. You were part of a happening there, a small part
of it. I was a part of that. Well, I've been hit on the head a couple of 100,000 times. So I don't, to see Mankind in a match, you know, and I had forgotten that, but hang on a minute.
All right. One sec. Okay. So
that's my wife and daughter talking.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we, well, in fact, no, I'm going to stick with this very briefly. With Mick Foley, a creative person, as you are, as being a booker for many years.
Yep.
What did you make of the Mankind character initially? Because that's really, really out there.
It was, but they made it work. Because it's kind of believable. If you really think about it, here's a guy that come off, he was off the streets or whatever, and how did he get into wrestling? Well, with wrestling, you have to stretch the imagination, but it was better than the Jim Herd stuff. Here he's, and you could see him talk like he was trying to be sane, but he just wasn't there. He was off. And it kind of, that's where you could get a lot of sympathy on him too, because he wanted people to like him, but, and the way he talked, I think he's had this character in him the whole time, and he brought it to life, and more power to him. He was a great performer. He really was.
You know, with Jim Herd, I think, like, if Mankind came out while ringing a bell and with a hunchback and maybe carrying an axe.
Yep.
That would work.
And being a Catholic priest.
That was a WWF one, not Jim Herd.
Well, anyway, he could have all these gimmicks and just compile them into one and call it It. It's everything.
No, because It is a Stephen King clown thing, Pennywise.
Or call it What with an upside down question mark at the end. What?
What about Who? But Jim Neidhart took that.
Who is a band?
No, that the Who. But the wrestler, there was a wrestler called Who, and it was Jim Neidhart under a mask.
No, it wasn't.
You were in the company at the time when he was there.
Wait a minute. All these things happened when I was there. I was there.
Yes.
And I don't even remember.
You're going to make me find... Okay, I'll find it. One sec. Hang on, right. Let me just Google this. Jim Neidhart Who. This has gone all sorts of wrong.
See, the story behind the Notorious Who. He had a mask on.
Yeah, can you see that?
Yeah.
Do you not remember this at all?
Maybe. I've seen so much shit. You can't remember it. You just can't. I don't think my mental capacity can remember all this stuff.
That's fine. We're going to move on. Big deal.
You can only see bullshit so long, and it's like a vacuum.
Big D from Tennessee, when you were working for Nick Gulas, who was booking?
Oh, at that time, Tom Ernesto.
He got around, didn't he?
Huh? Yeah, well,
because he booked Puerto Rico as well, I think, at one point.
He booked Puerto Rico, and he booked Atlanta during his heyday. He did very, very well there. But by that time, by the time he got out, which was a lot earlier than what I slid out of it, the wrestling business was imploding upon itself. And most territories were self-booked back in those days. They just did it themselves. So you didn't have the traveling bookers. And that's what he was, because he was too old to work. And so, but Tom Ernesto was the one booking the territory in Tennessee, which is why Savage and I took off, because I would ride with Tom a lot and we would talk about it, and I would have ideas and Tom would have ideas, and he would listen, seriously listen to what I had, and he would adopt it somehow, and it worked. So he didn't tell me it worked, but I could see that it was working. That was like my first knowledge of trying to book something, was just suggestions to Tom.
Next question. Ant in China. Hey, Dutch and James, I wrestled a bit in the Indies. Ant, Anthony, I suspect.
In China?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
There you go. I wrestled a bit on the Indies in the early 2000s, and whereas sometimes wrestlers could get a bit stinky, one thing that was always a noseful was the ring canvas itself. I highly suspect the indie groups I wrestled for in Canada never ever washed or cleaned the canvases, leading to years, maybe decades, of sweaty wrestlers leaving their scent upon them. Was it similar in Puerto Rico in the territory days for bigger territories and promotions? And how about huge companies like the WWF/WWE? I can't imagine they didn't at least wash the bloodstains out from time to time. Thanks, guys.
Actually, the WWF and WWE, it was a new ring canvas every TV. It was brand new every time. Even in their house shows, they may have taken that same mat from TV to the house shows. But after 1 week, it was discarded. I don't know what they did with all these discarded ring mats. I don't know what other use people would have for them, but that's what they did. Now, some of these independents, and let me tell you about a mat. If you ever get skin up in a ring and some of these mats, you're taking a real chance, because you can get an infection from the mats. They never clean them. They don't upgrade. They don't do anything but pack it away. So it's got a lot of germs and probably a lot of diseases in that mat. Guys didn't used to think that, but when you get into ring and you see it's dirty, you're taking a chance by going down on it. So if they don't have a clean mat, I mean, you know, it's at your own expense if you want to get on it and wallow around in it. I didn't much notice it when I started, but later on I said, damn, it's like somebody had bled in the ring, and it was still there, and it was like dirty, and it's you can catch several diseases from that. And if you have a cut, you know, and it gets in that cut, you're in bad trouble.
Did you ever get staph infection?
Never got one, but I have seen guys that have gotten them. And when somebody gets staph, you can't let them wrestle. You have to stop them then, because it's highly infectious, highly contagious. And if you got one guy with staff, your whole crew will have it. So unless you just want to shut down for a couple of weeks, let the guy continue to wrestle.
Did you ever get ringworm or anything like that?
No. No? What is ringworm?
It's like a bacteria that, like, my brother got it because he goes to Brazilian jiu-jitsu a lot, and he ended up catching ringworm, which is essentially just like a round circle.
Yeah.
Skin infection that ended up on his arm, and he was banned for 2 weeks because...
A ringworm. Is that an actually little worm?
I don't think so.
Oh, it's just a name, a ring.
Yeah.
It's a round, like, Okay. No, I never got that. I actually missed all these things.
We've done really well. Crikey, the amount of rings and stuff you wrestled in over the years, you've never got staph. What's the worst staph infection you ever saw? Because I was reading not too long ago The Undertaker describing a staph infection that he had in his arm in Puerto Rico in 96 when WWF were doing a brief tour of the island. Mm-hmm. You were probably on the card since you were managing Bradshaw.
No, I didn't go to Puerto Rico.
No, not with WWF.
Nope, didn't go.
What's the worst staph infection you remember seeing on someone else?
Oh, I remember hearing it from a guy, but of course he was banned from coming to the show. And I didn't see him for like 2 weeks, but I never saw the actual infection. I just knew he had it. Nobody else got it.
We are going to move on. And Luke from the UK asks, are the rumors of Robert Fuller's humongous wang true?
The rumors of a fellow compatriot, a fellow colleague of his wing wang, is it huge? I would have to say that I have been in a few showers with Robert Fuller, one of the big showers where you have faucets and I would have to concur that Robert Fuller is greatly gifted in that department. So he looked at me one night, and I'm going to say this. He says, Dutch, don't you wish you had one this big? And I said, Robert, tell the truth. I wouldn't want anybody to know my wife. It's so big either. And he didn't like that too much. But yeah, he's gifted. Let me say that.
Bernie Mac, I'm blessed.
And where did, wait a minute. Who asked this question?
Luke. It's always dudes wanting to know the size of other dudes.
Do you want to know what the size of Robert Fuller's ding-a-ling is? I mean, come on, man. It's pretty big.
Okay, I'll add a couple of things. One, is it true he could get it in a top wrist lock?
No, I don't think that, but he could probably get it in a penis bar. he could probably grab the top of it and, then grab his fist like that. He could probably do that. That's not a top bar, but it's it's an arm bar. It's a penis bar.
Yeah. Was he, because I'm sure there's some people back in the day.
So you've heard stories about him.
Yeah, a few. Now, is he one of those dudes who would, as soon as, like Dusty, just as soon as they got into the locker room, just get completely naked?
Yeah, kind of. He didn't give a shit. Robert was a fun guy. He really was. I mean, we talked about doing the snort. Robert, sometime when you see him, he was doing it and you didn't know it. That's one night I actually invented a match when I wrestled with Razor Ramon. Mm-hmm. And I told you that. Mm-hmm. Robert was all coked up and so was Razor. And I didn't want to get in the ring and take a chance with him because he was a big guy and I didn't know him. And so I invented a whole different match just for him for that night. And he remembered it.
That is one of my favorite stories. We said we'd retell it one day, but we'll save it for another one. we're going to move on. Jeremy has sent in very nicely AEW's current seat filler guidelines.
Yes.
An abridged version. Now there's nothing too amazing in here, but I thought you'd just like to know some of them. So I'll speed through these as best I can.
Now we heard about this from Louisville, right?
Yes. Now, WWE has had seat fillers for many years, and AEW has seat fillers as well, like the Oscars, like a lot of things that with an audience that broadcast on TV. So, Here are some of the rules that they set out for potential seat fillers. Your main purpose of the evening is to assist the television production, of course. Please arrive at the arena 1 hour, 30 minutes before your scheduled start time of the event. At this point, an AEW official will tell you what you're doing. AEW official will notify you when a seat becomes open. This is your sign to jump to action with an exclamation mark. You will be directed on where to sit. Remain in that seat until the owner, quotation marks, of the seat returns or an AEW official instructs you to move to it is... All right, it's just a bad sentence there. It is important that you are polite to those around you. Keep in mind that the seat you are occupying probably belongs to a friend or family member of those around you. Inform these people that you are only sitting in the seat until a person returns, so you actually can tell the people around you that you're a seat filler. Also, feel free to let them know that you're assisting in TV production. Once the ticket holder returns, quickly look at the seats surrounding this once empty seat to see if another seat needs occupying. If you see another empty seat, then sit in it. Yeah. There's only three more here, so feel free to bring your sign with you. If you are sitting in a seat that has an empty seat next to you, then use the sign to cover that chair. This way you can cover two seats at once. Unless you've got a person-shaped sign, but maybe it looks better on TV, I don't know. The last two things are refrain from having too many alcoholic beverages. The last thing we need is an intoxicated seat filler. If we determine that you are visibly intoxicated, you will be ejected from the arena. And the last one is... And this is the most interesting one. You can take pictures of the event for your own personal use. You can also post them to your social media accounts if you want. However, we ask that you refrain from mentioning that you were a seat filler. We do not want the general public to know that we use seat fillers. No videotaping whatsoever. So, you know, we've let that one out of the bag. But I think
we sure have.
Most people knew anyway.
Do you feel bad now?
Awful.
I swear to God, I never knew anything about seat fillers, even when I was with WWF or WWE. Never knew about it. I have seen some places they could have used some seat fillers to fill in the blanks, but they didn't have them that night. So I says, they didn't even give away free tickets, but that's what he used to tell TNA. Don't get seat fillers. Just go to smaller arenas.
With no seats.
That you... yeah, go and make them sit on the floor. that's what they do in Japan. They don't have the seats in a lot of those. Well, they didn't then. People just sat on the floor. They'd bring their little bamboo deal, I guess, and roll it out and sit on the floor. So you would walk out and there'd be people underneath you. You could look down and see them on both sides, which was kind of, you know, unsettling for a while, but you got used to it. Well, and you got used to the quiet in Japan too, because they're not like American fans. Wah, wah. They only do that on the comebacks. And then they get up and then they sit right down. I mean, the sound, it goes up, then it comes down. It goes right down.
I know this wasn't your thing in TNA because it would be someone else's job, but did they ever have seat fillers in TNA or no?
Not that I knew of. They would give away a bunch of free tickets. I knew that. And they would come in and fill the seats, but. Wait a minute. Do you just show up to fill a seat?
No, I think you've got to apply for it, and then you get this sort of message beforehand, because they tell you when to turn up, they tell you who's going to greet you, they'll give you a wristband to let the production people know that you're a seat filler rather than just a regular fan.
Well, you have to know they have seat fillers to apply for it, don't you?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, why didn't I know, me personally, why didn't I know that seat fillers were used? Did they keep it quiet? Wait a minute. They kayfabe me.
Mm.
That's what they did. I knew something was up, and now it's confirmed. Not only is wrestling fake, but they use fake fans out in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
Smarter than the average bear, Yogi.
Next question. Jimmy in Oklahoma says, hey, Dutch and James, I don't recall you guys talking about Cowboy James Storm. More importantly, his so-called boo-boo face when he had to do the job. Any good James Storm stories, and are there any other TNA guys who also had the boo-boo face that you can recall? So I don't know anything about this, so did James Storm have a boo-boo face?
No, I don't think so. He might not have liked it. I don't remember the boo-boo face. But they are some guys that you tell them that they want to lose. Oh, my God, it's like the end of the world. Oh, my God, you think they want to kill themselves. I said, what's the deal, man? Because, see, I'm used to going out there and doing it. Sometimes I would rather do it than go over. Because as a heel, I'm expected to get beat, so I can do that. And this is what, you know, I told you about maybe the last show. I talked about working with referees.
This show. That was this show.
Okay, I'm working with referees, but that's the last thing the fans remember. They don't remember that I lost. They remember what I did with the referee. Or they remember I used to pitch what I call a big hissy fit. I don't know what y'all call them in. No, it's like a baby.
That's the same.
Yeah, a big hissy fit, and I would lose the match, and I'd go over in the corner like I'm crying. People say, oh, stop crying. And I said, hey. And then I'd go to the ring, and I'm just so incensed. I'd just jump up in the air and just beat the mat. And they'd get a big pop out of that. Then I would take the mic, and I said, thanks to your rudeness and crudeness, and I would like to announce publicly right now, due to you, your particular behavior tonight, I'm announcing I will never, ever come back to this town again. And I leave, and that got a big pop. But see, that was better than the match, because they would remember that instead of me just going in and getting beat, and the last thing they see me is laying flat in the ring. At least I had life. So they would leave, you know, they wouldn't say, oh, Dutch got beat tonight. They'd say, well, Dutch pissed a damn big fit at the end of it, didn't he? And that's what they remember. That's what I wanted them to remember. So what was the question? Well,
it did relate. Let's have some names out of you then. Not like main event people. You know, like Steve Austin or something like that, where it really would have mattered whether he won or lost. But someone who was on the undercard who would fight you tooth and nail over a win or a loss. Do you remember any names?
Not right offhand, but see, WWE, they know better than to pitch a fit, because they just let them go. They wouldn't put up with it at all. TNA at one point tried to assuage guys, convince guys that it was in their best interest to do it. And of course, if it was part of the angle, I mean, it fit the angle with James Storm. And I like James Storm. I think he's a great worker. He's a good friend, but I never remember, but he didn't give a crap. I don't remember, but if it was part of the angle, he was fine. Now I can see his reluctance when we're just going to go out and beat him for no reason, you know, because he had been pushed pretty hard in the company. So him going out there and doing this for whoever didn't make a lot of sense. So I don't blame him there. Some of the other guys, let me think this guy's name.
Do you want me to
pause a minute.
Okay. Then. Okay. You thought of a name, Dutch?
I have thought of a name. And I like this guy, and his name was Loki. Loki did not like to lose because the most you can remember when you meet Loki is he has a different look about him, but his voice. What is the purpose of me losing? And I would try to tell him, whoever was giving him the finish would try to tell him, yeah, we're going to do this and this and this. I don't see the value in
I don't see the value in this.
Yeah, but, and again, I don't blame him, because to be in the wrestling business, I mean, as a booker and as an agent, you don't want to hear that, because now you got to say, well, yeah, but it's, we're going to do something with this. And sometimes you're just making it up. But if you're in the wrestling business, if you don't think you need to be in the main event, then you really don't, you don't need to be there. You got to think that you are more valuable, and the best worker on the card is called ego. But if you don't really have that ego and that personality, you really don't need to be there, because you got to think that you're the best and go out there and try to prove it every night. So I don't blame guys for that, but sometimes they are difficult to work with.
Next question. Spencer Yates, hello.
Why did you ask me that question?
Why did you ask me that question? Spencer Yates says, hello, Dutch. As fans of History of Pro Wrestling, we have heard tales of St. Louis and Kansas City being strongholds for the NWA since 1948. Wrestling at the Chase from Sam Mushnick's St. Louis Wrestling Club and Central States Wrestling at Kansas City has been talked about by legends like the Funks, Harley Race, and Ric Flair as the place to make it as a pro wrestler. With those two offices or territories being held in such high esteem from wrestling legends, however, almost every wrestler I have listened to speak about the area from about 1980 onward said the crowds were small, pay was terrible, and they couldn't wait to leave. And I think this is especially with Kansas City. The only insight I have heard about what caused business to go down in Missouri was from your dear and always honest friend Ric Flair, saying that Bob Geigel was the worst promoter of all time. I would like to know if you would have any insight to what caused the downfall of wrestling in that area. Thank you for your time and love the show. So the downfall of Bob Geigel in Kansas City specifically, and the Missouri area.
If you ever saw the show, you'd know. The TV show was the shits.
In what way?
It was just bad. It was just a bad show. It had a bad announcer. I mean, it was studio wrestling. But, and then they, at the top heel, they had Bob Brown, who was 5'8", weighed about 210 pounds, maybe. And he doesn't have a good presentation. I mean, the show was just bad, and he had no creativity about it. It was just a wrestling show, and you watched it, and not a lot of people watched it. And, you know, St. Joe, Missouri, is close to Kansas City, and that was like a weekly town, like a Friday night town, and a big building, too. It probably seat 5,000 people. They might have 200 people sitting out there on a Friday night, or maybe 300, but you could put 500 in that building, and it'd still look empty. I don't know why they continued to run it. Kansas City was terrible. I mean, You would think that that's their anchor town, and that's their hometown. They did zero there. The best town when I was there was Topeka and Wichita, and it's only because I'm not saying me, but I came up with this gimmick that the Oats boys were leaving. So I said, why don't we have a loser leave town match? And I learned a big lesson from this too. And we went to Wichita and Topeka, and they weren't sold out, but they were a hell of a lot better than they normally were. But when the Oates brothers lost, you could just hear this in the building. Because we didn't pay it off. Now, if we had lost, oh, that's a big one. You know, but the Oats boys were leaving, so I don't know what else we had to do in that, but I learned a valuable lesson by trying to even arrange that, because if you're not going to blow that off in a positive way, you really hurt yourself coming forward. Because the Oats brothers, they were over in the territory. Ted and I forgot his brother's name. Ted and I forgot his name.
Porridge.
But anyway,
Porridge Oats.
What's his name?
I'm joking. I just said Porridge.
Porridge Oats.
Come on.
Oh, my God. I went, what?
It's Jerry.
Jerry. Jerry Oats is his name. And I remember with a little prod from James. But when they lost, brother, when we come back a week later or 2 weeks later, it was crickets. I've said this before, you could shoot off a shotgun in the place and not hit anybody. And we weren't making any money. I could not wait to get out of there. This Bob Geiger didn't know how to book, and he didn't want to bring a booker in. And if you don't want to bring somebody in that will kind of has knowledge of how to book a territory, then you're just you're dead on arrival. And that territory was, it was horrible. And if you made St. Louis, now the same people didn't run St. Louis. They just sent talent over there because it was the closest territory. But you would have a good week. If you didn't have St. Louis, forget it. Because your week was going to suck. I spent about 6 months there. And in 6 months, I will never, ever be able to get back. And I regret for even going for 6 months.
I've seen Dusty and Rick, where Rick won the NWA title for the first time, like the footage. And the production values of that place is like the Lumiere brothers in 1890 had better production than Kansas City in 1981. It's shocking.
Horrible. It was horrible TV. It was just from the production to the creativity of the show. Even the announcers were bad. It was horrible. Camera shots, it was all. We could pick it to death, but I think we've already told, we've read the obituary of it, so we know how it ended up.
Next question. Claire asks, how close a guarded secret was Brian Christopher being Jerry Lawler's son? And do you remember the reaction when it was made public by Paul Heyman, I think?
Well, I think Jerry, and this is a vanity thing with Jerry, he didn't want people to know he was old enough to have a 21-year-old son or a 22-year-old son. He just didn't want people to know, because he tried to hang on to that mystique of being 21 himself or 22. He wanted people to still think that he was a young man. That's a vanity thing. But a lot of people knew, it just wasn't broadcast over TV. And a lot of people did not know until they finally let that out on TV. And Paul Heyman, he let it out, right?
Yeah, I think this was on like a Raw in 1997 where Paul Heyman said it. But that's the first time I remember hearing it on TV, at least. It was probably in the dirt sheets.
Mm-hmm. Well, the people who read the dirt sheets knew, but the majority of people didn't read those dirt sheets. You know, it was like an inside club, and they had all this inside information, and they knew this. But Lawler, he didn't want, and even when it came out in the dirt sheets in what, 97?
About that. No, probably okay. Earlier, but yeah.
Lawler didn't like that at all, because he had actually guarded against that in Memphis. We all knew it in Memphis. He didn't tell us that. We just said, well, he don't want people to know his age. So, and it was never, Lance never said it. Dave Brown, the announcers, they never said it. And because I think Lawler would end up punching his kid sometimes, because he was just a heel and go in there. And I think they tried to stay away from that, but it happened at times, I think.
I find it a shame that they never did like a lengthy father-son kind of storyline. I thought that might actually draw.
That might have. So,
okay, so our next question is Gary Henn. He says, my question is, did Dutch ever wrestle any of the Hart family? I know he has said he didn't like the traveling to the Northwest, but maybe they came to his area. Thanks for putting my question on the show.
Well, the answer to that question is yes, I did wrestle a member of the Hart family, not Brett, because when I was in WCW, I don't know if Brett was even there. Was in WWE.
97, 98, he went. Yeah.
But I did wrestle Owen Hart in a tag team match. And wrestling Owen was very, you could watch them in the ring. Watching Owen work in the ring was so different than watching Brett, because they had entirely different styles. working with Owen was, he was very, very good. He was easy. And I've heard from Brad, people that work with Brad, that he was kind of rugged, which I don't mind that either. But I think Owen did better stuff and more athletic stuff than Brett did. Plus you could, and Owen was a baby face. Plus you could get a little heat on him because he did an entire different, he sold differently. It was just a different guy. So yes, I did work with Owen Hart. Now the other brothers, I never even met them because I had a chance to go to Calgary one time and turned it down flat. I said, I'm not going. It's too damn cold for this boy.
With Owen, because he was at the time one of the most prominent high flyers, and when we think of high flyers now than in the early 90s, it's a whole different kettle of fish. But with working with high flyers like Owen or other people like that, how were you at being a base as far as catching them? Did you just try and avoid it?
I tried to avoid it at all possible costs, to tell you the truth. Mm. Oh, yeah, he had some great stuff. But remember, people, when a guy has great stuff, he has to have a great base. He has to have somebody to protect him. And just as we saw that Logan Paul, he protected Mysterio on the last pay-per-view. He had to step in and save him because he was going to hurt himself. But Owen, I didn't, because I'm the one taking the bump. I don't care what he does. If he does a high flying move, it's up to me to follow through with that move and make it look smooth. Well, after a while, you get a little, people are beating on you all the time. And so I try to, later on in my career, I tried to avoid most of that. But he was but Brett never did that stuff. Probably Brett would have fit more my style than Owen was. But we had a good match. So we got in it and got out of it. I'm sure I'm the one that got beat, but well, I don't know that because the match I remember, Randy Colley was in it. He may have got beat because he got hurt.
Broken arm.
Was it that? Yeah, he did get hurt. I forgot what it was now. Maybe it was a broken arm.
Yeah, I think the old story was that you've told on the show before was that Owen wanted to dive off the ring, the top rope, onto the outside, and he said to you, "Will you do this?" And you're like, "Nope." But Randy said he would, and he ended up getting hurt.
Randy said, "I'll do it." first mistake.
Okay, we've got either one or two more questions, depending on time. Francisco and 1.5-year-old Valentino would like to ask, "Hey, Dutch, remember first seeing you in WCW searching for Stan Hansen, which we were talking about in the last episode, but always saw you in the Aptomax. Huge fan of the show, and you may have stolen us from Cornette. Quick question, have you ever seen the Stan Hansen Nobody Potatoes Me video on YouTube?"
Well, I haven't seen that.
Well, why don't we watch it?
Yeah, let's watch that.
Okay, so here is apparently the initial potato. And this is slow motion. So the guy in the black, what looked like black trunks there, gave him a kick right in the face.
Damn. Mm.
I don't think I've ever seen Stan Hansen do a tope. Or a suicide dive, whatever it is.
Look, he's hot. You piece of crap. He's beating the crap out of him in the chairs. Look.
I'm going to skip
that. Terry Gordy, right? Terry Gordy with him?
Yeah. Bam Bam. He's there as well. I think he's... I'm going to forward this a tiny bit because he gives our man there two of the hardest slaps you'll ever hear in your life. So I'll... I'm going to rewind that and turn it up.
Wow. He slapped the taste out of his mouth. Is what he did.
Maybe give him one more. Have that.
Nobody potatoes me. No kidding.
There we go. Well, actually, I'm going to forward this to the end.
Yeah.
Where Stan Hansen says the following.
Nobody potatoes me.
There you go. Nobody potato Stan Hansen for good reason.
No kidding.
Oh, man.
Well,
Stan
you
was
would
a
think,
tough dude,
see,
man.
Yeah. Well, Stan liked that rough stuff. And they liked that rough stuff in Japan like that. But, I mean, Stan's 280 pounds. And he don't give a crap. I don't think you could beat him up if you wanted to. I don't think you could knock him out. And he would just maul you. And he just probably one of the toughest guys ever. I would like to see him against Haku. Mm-hmm. That would be a hell of a fight. But, and Stan, if you just met him, he's laid back and yeah, man. And, but you fire him up and you saw what he could do. Thank God that wasn't me, because if he'd have threw him and dived over the ropes like that at me, you know what the next thing I would have done? I just quit. I just run out the door. They say, where did Dutch go? And I'd be in the dressing room getting my stuff on so I could get out of there so I don't have to see him after the match. But he's right. Nobody potatoes Stan Hansen. And you know who else nobody potatoed? Bruiser Brody. Mm-hmm. They didn't do that either. So because if they did, they knew that they had an ass kicking coming, and they got it. So all you could do is just lay back and cover up, because you were going to get it one way or the other. And then, but when you get to the dressing room, they're not mad. They say, you okay? And you say, yeah, I'm okay. And shake hands and you go. It's just a part of doing business, because they know that you know that you did something wrong and you got punished for it. So the best thing to do is take your punishment, go on, don't bitch and moan about it. But if you wanted to bitch and moan, now back in the dress room was the time to discuss it. If you still wanted to fight, let's fight. But most of the times, that's what it ended with. We'll say, you okay? And shake hands and thank you very much and go.
Did you ever wrestle, Stan?
Wrestling is a weird business. It really is. Somebody go out there and just beat the dog shit out of you, and you're going to walk into a room and it says, you okay? And you say, okay, and shake hands and walk away. That's a weird business. What was your question?
Have you ever wrestled, Stan?
Hell no.
Because I was going to say, you would have eventually had to if he'd stuck around with the Desperados thing.
Nah, I don't think so.
No?
Well, they never said where it was going. This is what I thought. Well, eventually, we're going to have to find that bastard. And what I thought would happen was that he would clean all three of our clocks. And then we're sitting around. Now we're commiserating like, well, he just don't know what we need him for. Maybe we need to confront him. And after a cup of tea, he beats the shit out of us again. Yeah, we would have had to face him. But then we'd have to get him down and beat the shit out of him. Except we would do it, especially me, very carefully, and then create an angle with it and go from there. It couldn't have lasted long, but at least it was something. And because Stan can only beat people up so much without a story. So now he's going to give him a story, and that was a good one, and we could make it work. Now, I love the idea of us sitting around the dressing room after we got ice all over us and patches and stuff after he beats. But then we're trying to say, listen, if he just really knew, if he would just listen, we could convince him that this is in his best interest. If he would just listen. So then the people will say, well, what have they got to tell him? But before we get to tell him, of course, he beats the shit out of us again. Now he makes us mad. Oh, God, don't do that. Don't make the Desperados mad. And then we go in there and get the best of them, three of us, and then he runs us off, and now he's chasing us. Makes sense.
Going to finish. This needs to be a very quick answer because we've got to go, because we've actually got a special third episode that we're going to release in December that we've got to record very soon. Dylan says, hey, Dylan here once again. What's your prediction for the winner of the 2024 Royal Rumble?
I don't know who's in it.
No one knows who's in it yet.
Well, I don't know either. So why would I? How How would I know who the winner would be if I don't know who's in it?
Okay, who do you think would be most logical to face Roman Reigns at WrestleMania 40 then? Let's say that's the person who's going to win the Rumble.
Okay, let me say would be LA Knight.
LA Knight, okay. And?
And Cody Rhodes.
Funny you mention Cody Rhodes, because I have put a bet on, like 2 months ago, I'd completely forgotten I'd done it, for Cody Rhodes to win the Royal Rumble. £25 at 13-2, which is pretty good odds.
Cody Rhodes?
Yep.
Yep.
I bet my money on Cody Rhodes on that one.
That's what I would think.
Right, so we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much, everybody, for watching. As I say, this is going to be a very quick outro. Questionsfordutch@gmail.com. If you want to email your question for future consideration. And Dutch, thank you very much for joining us and entertaining us. We the people.
We the people.